Welcome to Shoot Me Straight. Dave Fields, Eddie Gallagher. We're here today with my buddy, Kurt Tobias. He is has a really great story. He's a founder of a clothing brand called Chuna. Did I say that right?
That's correct.
Yes. He's a local here on 30A. Just overall, great guy. Has been through a whole experience of founding a company. It's been 5 years?
From conception, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've got to walk through some of that with him, which has been really cool. How are you doing?
Great. Happy to be here.
So tell us, just give some background. You grew up in Washington?
I grew up just outside of D.C., Northern Virginia. Stayed there through high school and then went to college in Lynchburg, Virginia. So went to Liberty University, which I stayed in Lynchburg for just over 9 years before we moved down here to the Panhandle.
You went for engineering, is that right?
I actually got a degree in information systems with a minor in intelligence, and it was kind of always the goal to get to the stop that brought us down here, our first stop in Destin. And my very first job just stumbled into a position where ended up being the lead process engineer for a pick-and-place manufacturer. So we put parts on circuit boards. So it's a very interesting job. Got some certifications on how to program these machines. But basically, you just study them and figure out how do you make this thing more efficient? How do we pick up these random parts, these ball grid arrays, and put it on this board that we get one shot at it, and that part is $5,000. So honestly, that job taught me a lot, being in primarily a white-collar upbringing. You know, I did a couple internships in D.C., and then going into Lynchburg, which was all blue-collar. And my dad was a blue-collar man, but I don't know, he just always pushed us. You know, he was a mechanic by trade, owned a couple shops. And he just always pushed us, like, don't follow my steps, basically. And actually, like, you know, at times would, you know, for me particularly, he would be like, I would try not to bring you to the garage because I knew you wanted to use your hands and stuff. So my first engineering job was very hands-on. A machine would break, belts would break. We had to fix it right then and there. We're in trouble. So that was kind of the happy medium of the first corporate exposure and into a little bit more of like a mechanical background.
And you got married during that time, didn't you, while you were working there?
We did. Lindsay and I met on my victory lap at Liberty. I was just not quite smart enough to make it through in just 4 years, so I had to do it in five. Mm-hmm. She was transferring in from another school, and we met, which was a very interesting season of life for me. I had dated a girl, the only girl I ever dated, and basically was like, I need to be on this sabbatical, I need to figure my life out, and I need to grow my relationship with God, and just get some stuff, you know, dialed in, because all I cared about was the cross through college. And, you know, I'm on my last semester, and I'm thinking, shoot, it's the real world after this. And then everyone keeps telling me, you got to meet this girl at transfer, and you got to meet this girl. And I mean, Liberty's huge. It's not like a little tiny college. Like, it's a massive school. And I'm like, all right, everyone needs to relax about this. And then I see her a couple times. I'm like, all right. And then, you know, third time I see her, I'm like, all right, you know what? Maybe I do need to meet her. Yeah, we met and hit the ground running pretty quick. I specifically remember one conversation we had, our first conversation, and I remember driving home and literally just crying, being like, this, I totally doubted that God had a woman like this. And it seems very selfish, and it was selfish at the time, you know, thinking, God, where is this perfect woman for me? But, you know, he really did just plop it right in the right season, right timing. And those are the times you look back and you say, like, wow, like, how do we continue to doubt over and over and over when you can look back at these, like, perfectly timed moments of now you're ready. Mm-hmm. So Yeah, we met at Liberty when I should have been probably long gone from Lynchburg.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Then when you left there, did you immediately come to Destin or?
Yes. So we essentially, I was seeing the end of the road at this manufacturing job. Just wasn't the best environment. I was reporting to the owner of the company. It was about 75 people in it. And, you know, it was just getting crazy where I would leave work, go work out, see Lindsay for an hour, and I would go back to work and I would be working on the line, prepping it for contracts that I specifically told, you know, the owner or PM, we can't do this. And they still book it. And they're like, nope, we're going to do it. And so it was just getting unhealthy there. Lindsay was ready to move. We were basically driving to my folks' water house every weekend. So we're like, we're fish. We got to be by the water. Mm-hmm. She's from Fort Lauderdale. I was like, you know what? My brother was, brother-in-law and sister were stationed here at the time. I said, you know what? Let's go do a little recon trip and just check it out and see if you like Destin. And she just fell in love with it. So we said, we're not going to renew the contract and for our apartment. And we're like, let's just see what God has in store. And it came down to 2 weeks before we, like, literally was like, got a call. And they're like, do you need to look over? I was like, nope, I'm in. We're coming. Mm-hmm. We had no place to live down here. Literally, there was, at the time, there was oversaturated Destin. There was nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, so literally, we just typed in for the U-Haul, just Destin. And we just booked, like, stayed at a hotel the first few nights. And an apartment opened up just by chance. Lindsay drove over there immediately, got it, signed it. And that was kind of the start for our stay in Destin. Our love for the Panhandle.
That's a typical theme.
Well, it is. Like, and that's what's crazy. A lot of people we have on here and just a lot of people we know in the area all have a very similar story of what brought them to Destin. And mm-hmm. it's not a lot of them aren't like pre-planned, you know, it's all in God's timing and mm-hmm. and they moved down here and it's like this place is a blessing for a lot of people.
For sure.
And yeah, it's amazing. It's crazy. Each guest we have on that is a local from here has a similar story just like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They say they came down here to visit one time.
Yep.
And they pretty much are like sold.
Yeah.
And then they figure out how they can move down here full time.
Yeah. Well, I would say that was like the two-step process for us because Destin, we didn't even know about Santa Rosa Beach. Mm-hmm. And not that Destin isn't great or Panama City isn't great, but like Santa Rosa Beach is very special to your point. It's like there is a synergy here that everyone is working on something. Everyone is building something. Therefore, everyone cares about it. And the biggest, I would say, difference between all of those spots or anywhere I've ever been is that a corporate job did not bring you here to Santa Rosa Beach. I mean, there may be like two out there, but like, you know, you either got to make a crazy long commute every day or you got to start something.
Yep.
And it's like, that's what's cool about it is like everyone is out here just trying to figure this thing out and really living through it.
And it's very communal here too, right? So everybody knows that. So everyone's willing to help each other out in some fashion. Like, oh, you're getting this started. Well, how can I help you? And vice versa. So
very,
it's
very supportive community.
Yeah, which is freaked me out at first. It was like people were too nice.
Oh, dude, I was definitely freaked out when I first moved here. Pulling up in the – we similar – our story is very similar to yours, how we moved here. You know, it was like on a whim. I won't go through the whole thing. I've said it on the podcast before. But, you know, we bought a house sight unseen online, and then I just packed up my family, drove from California all the way to here. And when we first moved here, you know, I don't know anybody. I'm pulling stuff out of the moving truck and neighbors, everybody's coming out, like introducing themselves, like, hey, how can we help? Or and people are like bringing baked pies or whatever. And it freaked me out because it's from where I came from in California. It's like, well, what do you want? Yeah, like, what are you trying to get? You know what I mean? And it's just not like that here. It's people are like legitimately they're just friendly, nice people, and neighborly. And that's what makes this place such a blessing, you know.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, we felt that in Destin to a degree. And it was, although we didn't live by family necessarily in Lynchburg, Virginia. It was still close enough that it felt like we were close enough to just say, hey, it's just a 2.5 hour drive back to family. We're down here. It was like the first time that we had to like actually spread our wings and like be like, hey, you know what? Our community, I'm a big advocate. I think we have a healthy relationship with your family. You can say this confidently, but like, this is my family here. Like our neighbors, the people that we do community with, like that is our family.
Yep.
And they're going to be there for me. I have guys here that I love my biological brothers more than anything, but like these guys are real brothers to me. Like as just as much as, you know, someone that shares the same blood, because we actually do life together. And I think that's a very hard thing to achieve in a lot of areas. This is just one that promotes that very heavily.
Yeah, you adopted Harper. I mean, you know.
It's a mutual adopting.
Yeah.
Harper's a very good dude that has challenged me in numerous ways. So I hope
that's awesome.
At least done the same back.
Yeah. So y'all moved down here. Y'all get here. You quit your job before you moved?
Yeah. So it was basically, oddly enough, I got interviewed at this place on the same street. I mean, I could literally throw a rock to the other building, but it was over in Mary Esther. And the guy that was running the place, like I was like, this is not the vibe. And I remember going back that night. This is on our little recon mission down here. I'm like, I don't know if I can do this, but I was like, you know what? For the sake of us getting down here, mm-hmm. I was like, I'll do anything for you, Lindsay. Like, let's do this. And I'm like, there's got to be something else. Like, everything down here is, if you go on LinkedIn right now and you look up engineering jobs, everything is going to have the word senior in front of it. You know, it's 20 years of experience in this very specific, you know, missile fin. Like, it's like the most, they're creating these descriptions off of someone that they're looking at their LinkedIn. Like, it's that specific down here. So I'm thinking there's got to be something broader than that I'm not seeing on these recruiter sites. I go on Google Maps and I'm just clicking down the street. I'm like, oh, what's this place? I will say it unnamed here. But so that place, I reach out to them and I find the hiring HR manager. And I just hit her up on Messenger on LinkedIn. Just said, hey, I just threw in an application and I think I can qualify for this. I don't have 15 years of experience, but I was like, I've got a ton of experience in this specific area. And I was like, let me know if you guys are interested. She gets back to me right away. If I would have waited for their process, I bet you would have gotten flagged and said, oh, he didn't check the box. He has 20 years of experience. Mm-hmm. So would have never gotten the job to begin with. But anyways, we landed that one. And so we packed up, moved out of Lynchburg within like 15, 20 days. It was very close window. Like our lease was up. So it was like either we go live in this U-Haul up here or we just get down there and figure it all out. So, yeah. It was a little bit hectic of a time, so.
Founder's journey, right? Like, I mean, we're used to pressure.
But that wasn't even founder days yet. It wasn't even tapped into.
So what were you doing as your first job down here? Like, what was your...
So that one was for a DoD aerospace company, and that was a quality engineering job. Mm-hmm. And very extensive interview process. I mean, a full on, I got interviewed by like 10 people. And I met two younger guys. Demographically, it was way older mm-hmm. than that. If you worked on the assembly floor, it was much younger, most of the time predominantly women. And that's a part of the story of where I kind of got my passion for manufacturing and ethical sourcing and all that. But the two guys, I'm still pretty good friends with them today, they kind of sold me on it, honestly. I was like, all right, you know what? These guys, they seem like rad dudes. They like the outdoors. And, you know, they seem like they're acting like this is a good place. And so I was like, you know what? The pay raise, the tax break to come for, it was like literally doubling our salary. And we're moving half a mile from the beach, beautiful beaches. Yeah. And I'm like, what's not to love about this? So it was a slam dunk situation on paper and what we were envisioning at the time.
Yeah, that's awesome. It was a lot of ex-military that you worked
with?
Yes,
primarily in the, I would say in the middle management up is primarily ex-military.
Yeah.
So majority of my peers were ex-military, and then all the VP and executive staff were almost all ex-military.
That's what I figured. It's funny when you were talking about, you know, going on LinkedIn and then looking at everything, and it's everything's sort of written the same way, like senior, 20-plus years, this and that. That is exactly what is sort of not instructed, but put out to guys when they get out, like, hey, you use your experience, but then it sort of gets embellished a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. on LinkedIn or other resumes, like, oh, I did this for 20 years and blah, 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 blah. And it's, it just reminded me, because when I got out, that was the same thing, you know, and I'm glad they did it. They taught us how to build resumes and mm-hmm. put them on LinkedIn. But when you build your resume and they're, you know, instructing you, like, oh, make sure you put this, make sure you put that, and you read it, you're like, this seems like a little bit of an over-exaggeration of what my actual skills are.
For sure.
Know? Yeah.
it's a little blown out of the water most of the time, but it is interesting because, like, there was a branch that we had there that, you know, for me, I used to look much different than I do right now. You 5 years ago, you would have never seen a tattoo on my body. My hair was high and tight, perfectly combed over. I had a tucked in polo. And that was the look. You know, I knew how to play the game.
Yeah.
We'll just say that. But I was always a little bit more envious because I love the more, like, rugged, outdoor, like, there was a division of our thing that it was, I don't know if any of this stuff is proprietary, so we won't list any names, but there was guys in it that were all, like, ex-Special Forces guys.
Yes.
And so it'd be like, 30 of you would be in this area, and they would just close it off. And they're like, you're like, what do they do behind there? And, like, all the cool dudes walk in, and they're all tatted up. They're wearing, like, shorts and a shirt. And you're like, we're all in polos looking like a bunch of nerds. And these guys roll in and just start banging on things. And they're like, all right, it's good. So it was always cool because, like, to your point, is there is a place they know exactly, like, hey, when you're leaving, there is contractors like, oh, by the way, Eddie's leaving, so give him a call. We have a job for him. And that's exactly what all those dudes had, is like, they're just waiting for people to leave their military career. And then they're like, oh, by the way, we got this spot for you.
Because
most of them, if they're like techs or whatever, they were doing the same thing in the military. Now they're doing it. And then now they go in on behalf of the contractor and they're training the military to do it. So it's like this endless circle of people doing basically the same thing, just for different people.
It is. Parties. Yeah. And it's just probably more money than they made in the military.
For sure. Yeah.
Which is, that's cool. I think I like that. So that, I mean, it gives placement for guys in transition.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I mean, I think it's an awesome thing. And that's where most guys, I mean, it's just the network, right? You know who to call, you know, call or ask advice from, or like, hey, I need this job. And it's just this big circle of, especially for my community, you know, special operators, they all sort of work in conjunction with each other and help each other out. And I think that is a very good thing. I think the one con that I'll say about it is it sort of puts a block on being able to be yourself. And like, hey, I want to pivot and actually change who I've been for the past 20 years. Not completely change, but I want to do my own thing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think that sort of stops guys because they get comfortable. They're like, well, at least I have a job and I'm getting a paycheck, which is fine. But it sort of prevents them from going out and seeking something else that maybe they would be more, I don't know, happier or invested in doing. You know what I mean?
I very much agree with that. I think I don't know which shark said this on Shark Tank, but I want to say
Cuban.
I don't think it was Cuban, actually. But they said, you know, they give someone a salary to forget their dreams. And to your point of, like, you have people that are profiting greatly off of someone with a skill set. And just because you have a skill set, and you got to make ends meet. So, like, I'm not demonizing the corporate realm.
No.
I'm not demonizing anything of, like, you know, if you're happy and you get to live the life that you want to live and you get to impact people, that's the best case scenario. Like, don't put yourself at financial risk to go do that. But, like, if you feel called to do something, people are terrified and paralyzed to fail. And failure is a beautiful thing to refine someone to be what they're actually supposed to be.
Yeah. You got to go through that gauntlet.
I agree with
right?
that.
And yeah, it's just remind you know, you're talking about when you first moved here, he's like, you wouldn't recognize me. I was high into, like you, and I call it, or you're a conformist. It's like, I am conforming to what exactly, whatever corporation I'm working for wants me to be. And I can probably, you know, probably guess like you're a lot happier now, like being like, I'm myself. I can wear what I want, you know, grow my hair out, do whatever, and actually do what I want to do. But that taking that leap to get to that point is the scariest part for most people, and myself included. You know, it's being, having a job, getting a paycheck is comfortable. And you're like, and you're doing what you're supposed to do. You're providing for your family. But at the end of the day, like, I think that for some of us, that only gets you so far, because are you truly happy with what you're doing, or are you just going through the daily grind of, I need to make some money and I have my 9 to 5, I come home every day. And to me, for some guys, that's almost like slowly dying. It's like, okay, well, you could be doing so much more. Your potential, you have no idea like what you can be, but you don't know that unless you take that leap.
I mean, just to piggyback on that, I do think that it's just you're lulled to sleep over this long period of time. You don't even realize that you're just numb to the fact of someone is greatly profiting off of you. And I understand that. I mean, that is business at the end of the day. And you're giving someone a job, even a very well-paid job at times. But to that point, I really do think that, someone asked me this week, they said, like, wasn't it scary to leave? And I was like, 100%, I was terrified. Honestly, someone just caught my bluff and said, we'll throw money at it if you do it. If they wouldn't have done that, I may have never left. But for me, I look back 2 years from being out of the corporate realm now, 2.5 years now, I say it's scarier to think that I wouldn't have left.
Yeah.
Like, it's terrifying to think that, like, just a different shift, different perspective of life, now all of a sudden you're like, wow, how was I not seeing that?
Yep.
So it really is timing and being ready. And I think that corporate, the 7.5 years in the corporate realm, were just prepping me as a stubborn mule to be like, this isn't your place. Like, you can play this game as long as you want, but this is not it. So, you know, the sedating of cash in my account just wasn't providing enough, you know, I guess, meaning for what I felt I need to do. Now it's the opposite. Now there's no cash going in my account.
But you probably couldn't be happier, right? Yeah. It's like, and it's great. I like that term, sedating with cash in your account, because that's what it is.
It's
true. There's a lot of people, though, that I've come to learn, because I try to convert people to be an entrepreneur all the time, in a sense, just because it was such a truth for me. Like, a 9 to 5 kills me. Like, if I'm in a 9 to 5, it's actually the pressure of the idea of another day of that that makes me, I have to be hustling on the outside to figure out how I get out of this. But there's a lot of people that they're not necessarily founders or entrepreneurs. They want a good position, but most people want some flexibility within that position. They don't want to own the company necessarily. They're not as interested, but they need some freedom. They need some wiggle room, and they're kind of in that place that, you know, they can work themselves up to a position that they have some flex, that they don't have to be in the office, you know, in a cubicle, from 8 to 4 or whatever. But then the idea of, like, taking on, you know, figuring out marketing, figuring out sales, figuring out getting your accounting straightened, like, all those things, I mean, it just crushes them, and they don't want that.
Yes.
And so I've learned over the years of, like, man, this person could be a right-hand man. This person could possibly be a co-founder, super skilled, really good, but they want that. Their personality type maybe is just the type that they – just like to have the work in a box, and then they're done, and then they could do whatever else. As long as they have some freedom within that, that's their sweet spot.
Well, it's good. It's comfortable, right? It's, you don't have to worry about where's my next paycheck coming from, you know, and how am I going to make this work? It's pretty much all that's done for you. It's the same. That's why it's a lot of guys in the military are used to that, because in the military, you know you're getting paid no matter what. Like, that paycheck's coming on the 1st and 15th, as long as you don't cause any waves or do anything stupid. But, yeah, I had this conversation with my buddy the other day, and he's, you know, doing the entrepreneur route. And he's very successful. He created the GBRS group. They were just down here. We did put a bunch of training on at the range. But we were talking, and I was like, you know, how do you, you know, how's it going with everything? And he's like, you know, it's never like, dude, it's awesome. He's like, oh, it's, you know, it's going. And I feel the same way, too, with trying to build our business and, you know, brand and doing all that. I just feel like you're constantly just treading water, and, you know, your head's going down for a while, and you come back up for some air, and then you're doing it. And it is scary. It's not, you know, it's not like a comfortable feeling, but at the same time, I'd rather feel that way than, like you said, just be sedated going through life as a 9-to-5. Yeah. You know, I want that. You want that struggle on a daily basis, because it's not boring.
Yeah,
it's never boring. You are constantly trying to figure things out. How can I make this work? And a lot of it is the unknown, for me at least, too, because I have no clue how to start a business, how to do any of that. I was never paid attention to any of that stuff while I was in, or did I do well in high school, you know, enough to know anything about business. But I do like the fact it's sort of learning on the job training, right? You're like, okay, well, I just screwed that up. Now how am I going to fix that? And when you're working for yourself, you are able to pivot a lot easier than you are if you were working for somebody else and you have to sort of ask, like, hey, can I do this now? And they're like, no.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the mantra of an entrepreneur. Oh, I just screwed that up.
Yeah.
Like, how do I fix?
I mean, you know,
go that way.
So many people, I mean, how many times you heard that? Like, oh, that must be nice not working for a boss. Like, get to work for yourself. Or you're your own boss. Like, and I always just like, that's accurate. And I would always promote the self-employment or entrepreneurial route over being employed by someone, because I think it does challenge you as an individual. It's not, we talked about this recently, it's not work-to-life balance, it is life. And that shouldn't be a negative term to say what I do for a living, because it's not a career, it's who you are.
Yeah.
You actually are living out something. If it's a craft, if it's you're just an absolute wizard and you know how to build businesses and build them and sell them and all that stuff, like, there's so many different ways to look at it and slice and dice it. But I think we just demonize this idea that, like, either you overwork so you're this workaholic and then work is bad, versus, hey, I'm extremely passionate about what I get to do. Mm-hmm. And
that's the key, use that passion.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And, like, you know, but there's going to be, I think we're in a stage right now where, like, authenticity is valued so much higher than anything else, where, like, people want to hear that a founder, like, doesn't have it all together. Like, I know a ton of very legit companies and the founders that started them 6-8 years ago, and they talk about the things they had to do at the early stages, and you're like, oh my gosh, like, how did you get from that to this? And I look back, and every time I hear those stories, it just reminds me that, like, everything, the script is playing out perfectly for this, for us. Because I'm like, I've done that tenfold, you know, the mistakes, you know, whatever it may be, like hiring the wrong person, wrong contracting group, wrong manufacturer, everything under the sun. And now you look back and you're like, whoa, there goes another $100,000. But it made you this much better over here. And now you're refined. And that pain, you would have never gotten there without that pain process, the growing pains of understanding it. Like, people ask, hey, would you have just made the jump if you knew how hard it was going to be to get to where we're at right now in Chuna? And I would say, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because I would take the ignorance over that all day. If I knew how much money that we would go liquidate our retirement account, that we would borrow money from family, that we would do all these things that put stress on your family, your marriage, things within our marriage. Like, my wife is also an entrepreneur and much more successful than I am. And,
same.
You know, but it's taken a toll on us. I mean, you guys can probably, you know, if you both have started something, like, you know, Dave, you and your wife, like, people reward and glamorize the grind and the hustle, I demonize it because I'm like, hey, just because you're passionate about it and you love doing it, all this stuff, but when it trumps your marriage and the things that you love in life, you're doing it for the wrong reason. And like, we have to put in the work. Like, we don't stop working, but you know, at the same time, like, we've drifted off in seasons of our marriage where we looked at each other like, we don't know if we're gonna make it. Not like financially, like our marriage.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it's like, you know, it gets hard because you think, hey, this is now my first love, because this baby project that you're working on, you can't get it out of your mind. And so, you know, there has to be that balance, there has to be the structure. And out the gate as a founder, you're reckless. Mm-hmm. Because you'll never make it past stage one of
You kind of have to be.
As a founder, you have to be radically insane and arguably very dumb at times, because you just like, oh, we just lost money there. Let's go reinvest again. And you're like, oh, let's do it again. I don't have any money. Well, I'll go borrow it.
Yeah, I think we've taken the attitude, because same thing, where when we mess up or it's like, oh, we just lost all of that. Now we're, you know, or we're in the red now because we made this decision. And it does, like, it gets stressful, especially if you and your wife are both working together on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really, like, no one to blame except it's us two, right? Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, in the marriage, it's like, well, it's your, you know, we don't do that. But it can, like, get to that, like, well, you made the decision, and, yeah. Like, what? Like, you know, and it can go back and forth. But we view it as, like, okay, like, we might go through that stressful period of, like, oh, shit, we just messed up again. But at the same time, we're like, cool, well, at least we know not to make that same mistake again. It's all knowledge and experience that you're building. And as you move forward, you're like, well, now that we've made these 10 mistakes, we can now put either those in the contract, like, hey, this is what we need now. Because that's one thing you learn, too, is like making contracts and doing all these things, especially working with partners or doing collaborations. You learn on the way, like, because I think we were talking earlier, like, you know, not everybody that you collaborate with or you partner with has your best interest in mind, right? And
yeah, very those
are
that.
Yes, yeah. And so those are the things that you have to go through, and you can't really get mad at those people, like, for wanting their piece of the pie or, like, even more than that, because you're like, that's business. And for me, I've had a hard time, like, it's not that saying, you know, it's not personal, it's business. Mm-hmm. Well, it's like, it is kind of personal, right? I take it personally, but yeah. It's also learning to try to not take it personal, yeah. You know, and applying that to the business and pushing forward.
That's a great point, because I think of that all the time from social media interaction, all these things that people will, you know, we actually get phenomenal feedback across the board, and it feels like a dream at times. But like, we also have like some haters out there from time to time that just, they don't like what we're doing. They don't like our product or whatever. And you know, that's just, The bigger you grow, and it's almost like a pat on your back, like, hey, we made it to the next layer,
yeah.
Next layer of the network of people that we're reaching. But something to be reminded of, I think, and that's something that I've had to like continue to take that personal aspect out of, is because people view, when your brand is strong, they do not view one person behind it, or two people, or three people. They're like, oh, this is a legit brand.
Yeah.
So it's something that's like this very underlying, flattering comment when people are complaining about something or don't like something that we're doing. And it also is like to absolutely just kill them with kindness.
Yes.
It's just like, to me, I've said this to so many people, like, it doesn't matter what your product, what your brand structure is, what your service is. At the end of the day, if you bring good customer service to them, it doesn't matter what it is, I think you'll thrive. Because people
for sure
don't care about customer satisfaction anymore.
Yeah.
Like, think of the last time you flew somewhere and your flight got canceled. You went up to the desk. They're like, oh, sorry, we don't have any hotel vouchers, don't have any flights. And tomorrow we might be able to get you on one on standby. Like, they just don't care.
Yeah.
And that's literally everything now. Like, there's very few things. And whenever I get a sense of that with something that I purchase personally, I just take it that much more serious. And I want to support them anymore because I feel that on the other end. And so I think that's, this holistic approach to being like, you know what? It is personal, and like,
yeah.
I want to personally thank you by sending over my dollars to you and not supporting someone that doesn't care about it.
Yeah, being grateful.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's so much to be done with that. And
Well, there's studies. There's studies when looking at second-time founders, and especially in software as a service, that second-time founders, that means they started, bootstrapped a company, maybe had initial seed investment, and made it through and was acquired or sold it, and they're starting in another company. From the get-go, the number one thing that second-time founders are doubling their investment in is customer service. Ones that have been successful, they built something up to a point that it was acquired.
Yeah.
And now when they're starting another one, they already know, doubling down on customer service.
Yeah.
I don't know if my software company would have made it if we didn't from the – I mean, we were doubling down on customer – I mean, dude, it was so bad in the beginning. Our software was – it was so buggy. Like, my first presentation, I was afraid to click on anything. Like, I just pointed to stuff because, I mean, I had coded that first, and it was so bad that I was like, okay, as soon as I click anything, it's going to be an error and blank screen or whatever. And then it wasn't until later on that I finally got to a place that – sorry, that's my phone. Of course. It wasn't till a place later on that we got to have a development team and get to that. But even in those beginnings, as long as we were doubling down on making sure that we cared about them, we understood their problems. And even today, if someone messages in, needs help with something, our deals, we respond within the hour. We don't have to fix it. They just need to be known that, hey, we heard you. We heard you, and we're going to do something about it.
Yes.
You know? So I think there's no excuse for not having really, really incredible customer service.
Yeah. Well, I think everything is – everyone just views, specifically in software, consumer goods, high-volume business models, it's just about reaching the next checkpoint of how many people, how much revenue, versus, hey, I want to have – 100 of the most loyal customers. How do I acquire that? Well, I return in favor. I go up to bat for them. If there is something wrong with the product, even if we don't have a warranty on it, we give them a new product.
Yeah.
We're timely in our response. Like, to me, I think there's so much more value in word of mouth marketing than anything else. I mean, yeah, you know, we're experiencing more than ever our campaigns, our digital campaigns right now, but like, when you actually go up and it's like a personal transaction, say, hey, man, sorry to hear about that button or whatever, because I know from both ends and studying the industry for so long, it takes one button, one label, one snag in a garment that's top shelf priced for them to be like, I'm never going back. But all sins are forgiven when you go and say, hey, new product, I'll have it. Don't even worry about, by the time it gets back to me, you'll have your new pair, your new hoodie, whatever. And, you know, some of those slip through the cracks because I don't have full bandwidth and we do quite a bit of volume now. But I still, to this day, and for as long as I can, and then that will be part of our first hiring, is like, hey, yeah, you're in charge of creative director, but also you're in charge of customer service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, no one slips through the cracks. No one is not important enough to say. I've even had people who are like, I didn't, you know, a big story behind our product is made in USA, so all of our core items are manufactured here, and that costs a tremendous amount to do that.
Yeah,
and there's, you know, numerous reasons why we do that, but there's certain things like headwear that is not made here in the States. Those are imported, and it's like nearly impossible. I've done 6-8 months of research to find a headwear supplier that will do something more than very basic in the US. And it's like, it's essentially impossible. Mm-hmm. And so we've had people before, hey, I was misled, I was missold that this hat or whatever wasn't made in USA and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, hey man, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. And they, you know, continue to feedback. And they're like, hey, I hear you. What can we do to make it right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just, and I'm just like, you know what, how about you just send it back?
Yeah.
And we refund you. Mm-hmm. And no harm, no foul. So it's like, yeah, you know, it's one of those things where no matter what you do or who you are, you're not going to be the right thing for everyone.
Yeah.
No.
You can't satisfy everyone. And all you can do as much as, like, even those things, like, I think that just means that you care. But, like, those things, it's gotten a little number, but like those things will like eat me up where I'm like, man, like we try so hard to deliver the best product, the best service. And like people overlook it. People, you know, a lot of times my target guy in my mind is the one that brings down the brand the most. You know, this guy that is loves America and is like all, you know, and then he'll see the price of the shirt and he's like, yeah, right, I'm going to Walmart. And you're like, bro, that is the exact opposite of what you should be doing. You know, it's like, you want to actually support this country. You want to actually grow its economy. Like, look at the origin of manufacturing. Like, I'm not saying I don't want to demonize every location because that's a whole nother topic, but like, there's a trickle effect to that. You know, our stuff is being exported more and more every year. And it's like, people don't realize that it's really just taking more out of their pocket. They're kind of missing the point.
Yeah.
So, and on top of like, that's just an economic perspective. One of my favorite quotes is, you know, you can't afford to buy cheap. Like, you can't afford to buy something that's just going to break in 5 days. Mm-hmm. You know, you want something, hey, I put a little bit more in than I probably have right now, but that's going to last me 10 years. And just not everyone was raised or views that same methodology. It's a very interesting thought process of like, how do you cover all the bases and what's most important at times?
Yeah. And I also think if you're trying to please everyone all the time, then you're going to run the risk of not being authentic anymore. Mm. I think that's a huge thing. It's just, you can't please everybody. You know, you can try, and do your best to like, hey, this, like you talked about, like the hats. It's like, we would love to find a hat somewhere. We've looked, like we've done our research, we've looked around, and this is what we have right now. Mm-hmm. But you are always going to have those people like, you know, the negative. And at the end of the day, that's why you got to pick and choose what the critics that you listen to or the critiques. Sure. It's like, you cannot go to every critique and take that upon yourself and be like, oh, you know. Because there's just certain people out there that you're just not going to please anyways. And at the end of the day, it's a correct, like, okay, well, then send it back. Mm-hmm. You're just not the customer base that, you know, we're looking for. So,
yeah, I agree with that.
Has it been really, like, the struggle of starting a clothing manufacturer specifically? Mm-hmm. Like, how's that been? That's a tough industry, honestly, I think. From my side, any like, physical goods industry is tough. Like, I'm spoiled with software, but with like, you're always, especially if you're bootstrapping it for the most part, you're gonna be in debt constantly. You're gonna be trying to figure out how you're gonna pay for a design, how you're gonna get it out there, marketing. Like, there's a lot of upfront expense in getting it past those first hurdles.
Yeah,
like during that time where you just trying to do everything yourself for the most part, or are you just grinding away, learning design, learning materials?
So when I was an engineer, that was when it was happening in the car ride home. You know, I was just totally bootstrapping this thing, throwing money at, I mean, this guy eventually just stole money from me. Never met this guy, just through a network of people. We stumbled with 3 or 4 different development agencies out in California. So basically the two main hubs for garment manufacturing that still is in the States is New York and California. And California still has like a pretty big industry side to it, a lot more than probably people would realize. And it's trickled throughout the country, but it's minimal. And it's also manufacturing of soft goods, cut and sew. You don't just go on Google and where do I find a cut and sew manufacturer here? Like, it's very hard to find. They don't build out their websites like that. They don't have the margins to do that per se. So it was just stumbling after stumbling, probably so many times to just throw in the towel. I mean, I remember one of our first things that we got was like a belly shirt. Like, it was legit so short on the torso. I was like, and I mean, that's a couple G's. Like,
yeah.
You know, we're doing like very small batch, like, hey, make me 100 of these things. But when you're doing like, you know, top shelf fabrics and all these different things and U.S. manufacturing, construction, cut sew, like it is not cheap. You know, like a t-shirt will cost you $30 landed. And so you're like, all right, give me 100 of those things. And you're like, it's going to cost me that much. Like, all right, let's do it. And you get it, and you're like, this is garbage. Like, I've had things literally that I'm like, I will not even try to sell this. I can't, because then the brand is tainted. You know, it's just like, oh, you guys sell junk?
Yeah.
You upsell junk? Like, so I would just say, like, it's just taking a lot of refining and stubbornness to get to where we're at. Where now we're the well-oiled machine of, you know, once upon a time it used to take us anywhere between $5,000 and $10,000 to fully design, develop a garment. Now we've built all of our structure where we can build off existing products because we've done it right from the ground up. So it gets cheaper and cheaper and less labor to get to new garment designs and all that stuff. So it's a very long, heavy lifting up front, but it does trickle down. And I think once the brand hits the next major checkpoint, I would say it being acquired, like then you go in and say, all right, now we're pushing to this big outerwear space. And then there's all this upfront lifting again. But usually that happens with a parent company that has development groups already in play. They pull from design books. They have a manufacturer already does it. So, you know, it's all, you know, they just put it in the same factories that they're making their other brands out of. So,
Where did you come up with the name Chuna?
So, Chuna is it's actually a play on of tuna.
Mm-hmm.
So Australians say their T's like cha, and at the time I did not know this at all. On my breaks as an engineer, I go to Panera and just kind of like dream and scheme on my hour break of like what could life be like out of this place and. At the time we had gotten our first rendition of a logo, and our main logo in the C has a fishtail in it. And our first name, was already trademarked. So my trademark attorney's like, which is another thing. I knew none of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you go out there, well, you better protect your logo. What does that mean? All right, well, go get an attorney. All right. How much is that going to cost? I don't know. $5,000 later, you're just like, what? And she's like, yeah, you'll get that certificate in a year. You're like, what is happening here? You know, and so we had the C, and the C was so strong graphically. And she's like, basically, in soft goods, there's no just generic names that you're going to be able to just take from. Everyone is squatting on them right now.
Yeah.
So she's like, go make up a name. And I literally was on the phone with her. I was like, how do you make up a name? I was like, what does that even mean? And so I'm sitting there. I kid you not. I mean, I could probably find my little notebook somewhere. I have a line of just me making up names with a C. Because I was like, the C is, it can't leave. And I kid you not, this Aussie lady goes up. And I just overhear, I even have headphones in. I overhear her. She's like, I hear her Australian accent. She's like, can I get a tuna salad? And I was like, Chuna. I was like, I love that. And I wrote it down and I texted it to like awesome. 20 people and I said, Chuna, what do you think? And everyone was like, I hate it. What does it mean? And I was like, you're wrong. You'll figure it out. And so we had no meaning behind the name at first. It was just like, it's a play on to tuna. And my wife is very, very creative and overly well-read and just very savvy with words and thinking outside the box. And we're on a flight. This is probably a few days after we'd like, this is the name. This is it. Now we got to refine the logo a little bit. And the trademark attorney's like, hey, you need a tagline. We're like, okay, what is that? So I start looking at what is, you know, Yeti coolers built for the wild, you know, all these different things.
Yeah.
Like Costa, see what's out there. And so I grew up watching all these fishing shows. I'm thinking, wow, we got to just make this catchy little line here. And so we said, how can we make it some sort of play on to tuna? And we're like, choose this, choose, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, choose your nature. Lindsay's like, choose your nature. And I was like, I freaking love that. I was like, that was the moment right there on that plane that literally, I mean, we hadn't even been selling anything yet. And I said, this will be something. Like 100%, zero doubt. this will become a big brand in the outdoor space. I felt the branding, the tagline, and the tagline just speaks to me personally so much. I think it was actually my first tattoo. And it's kind of corny if you don't get it, because you're like, choose your nature. It seems kind of like frou-frou. But to me, it's like, choose, like, what's your backdrop? What's your natural habitat? And, like, that's where you're most alive. And to me, I was like, Chuna was embodying this, me leaving this corporate realm, living this amazing lifestyle we have on the Panhandle, being able to expand what this waterman's lifestyle looks like, and really living life, learning new crafts, being self-sufficient, being able to do all these different things. And like, it just spoke so much to me of like, this backdrop, this cubicle is not me. Like, it's the woods here, it's the water, it's the beach. And I think everyone has somewhat ability. I think it is, I would not say it's, I think it's a privilege to be able to make the state and be able to sit here right now and speak to you guys this way. So I don't want to undermine people that do not have an upbringing that allows them to be put into positions, but I do believe everyone has a choice in life.
Yeah.
And that's where it's almost like this empowering to someone to be like, hey, remember that you have the choice. And like, don't be afraid to choose and actually go do something that is a little off the grain, a little off the beaten path. People look at you and say, dude, you're crazy. Why would you leave a good engineering job? You're already in a senior role position. Like, I had people, family members that doubted me so much, but be like, I believe in this wholeheartedly. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, but do I really? And that just takes time, where there is no zero doubt in my mind. It's just a matter of when now.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. I like the origin of the name and that story. Mm. That's cool.
Yeah. You spoke to Eddie's nature.
Yeah. He's choosing it now.
Yeah. Choose what you want to do.
Yeah. That's right.
Awesome, dude. Well, thank you, dude, for coming out here and having this conversation, letting us hear your background.
Yeah.
What would be one last piece of advice for a guy that's going, hey, I'm in a 9-to-5. This is not my nature. Like, I don't know 100% what I want to do, when they're just in that in-between period. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give that guy or girl?
Yeah, I didn't want to correct you for you.
Such a chauvinist, Dave. Yeah.
He knows his audience. I would say, I'm actually asked this question a lot, and my infamous phrase is, you're nothing till you're something. People don't give a rip about who you are until your name and your brand starts being plastered on things. And all of a sudden, the secondary, the third group of people, the tears start flooding in, and you're like, I remember the brand loyal people out the gate. And I ask this question, and I'm asked this question a lot. I would just simply say, like, be excited to go grow and fail. Like, it's a very cynical thing to be like, you need to go fail, like, really bad. Like, to a point where you almost have a panic attack. I've had a few. I don't recommend them, but I think that it really does build you in a way that people are, again, so sedated that they don't even know what living feels like.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm the biggest pet peeve of mine is when people give advice and they haven't experienced something. Not to say you can't give advice, but it resonates and it lands better when you have actually done it. Where I'm like, I have done the corporate thing. I played as hard as I could. I gave everything. I believed what I was doing. It was never one foot in, one foot out. But experiencing the other side now, I can honestly say, like, I was not alive. I was dead. Like, I feel the heartbeat of life daily when I wake up now. So I think that would only be achieved by failing and having the desire to be like, it's okay if I go fail again. Because I know I'm just getting better and better to go be who I believe God's called me to be.
Fail upwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep falling forward.
That's awesome, man. Where can people find you? You get a social media handle and
Website. So our social, that they probably shouldn't follow the personal. There's not a whole lot happening there. But our social is Tuna Clothing, and our website is tunaclothing.com. And same thing for YouTube. I believe it's Tuna Clothing as well. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you, brother. I appreciate you coming on here and talking about your brand and also dropping all sorts of wisdom for people that are looking to be entrepreneurs, man. And also thank you for being vulnerable and talking about everything that you've been through. So
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been awesome.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Awesome. Out.